Some DJs call themselves musicians, but it's a lie. Mine don't.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, there's a great image that was floating around StumbleUpon for a while, where it showed, you know, one of these guys behind his turntables in a club with a bunch of people, you know, going, "Hey, ain't I cool? I can play other people's music." And that's exactly what I think of it.
Yeah, but Bob, that's a valid job function. I mean, not to diminish it too much. That's people need DJs who would play the music.
DJs need love too.
And I'm not saying that there's not a place for it, but the concept that you can, the idea that you've mixed in between these discs. And you call it a new piece of music and release it, I have a real problem with.
Well, that's Ice Baby, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, we talk about that too. There's a whole thing about the older generation, what we call Generation 1 DJs, who are not particularly thrilled with the new DJs who use sampling and then mix that in such a way that it sounds like new music when it's really just old music that's been hijacked.
Yeah, and I mean, I kind of go, we got to go. So I'm getting that from Bob. So we'll maybe
We've done it again, guys.
I wanted to go.
Yeah, we've taken another hour out behind the barn and beaten it half to death. But thank you both so very, very much. On his way, John Fox with All Foxed Up. Off to bed, Peter Godbold, the world's most fabulous LGBT conversation radio host. And in closing, here's the late great Lowell George reminding you to
on stage, but it's very, very special because if you can see, the numbers all go to 11. Look, right across the board, 11, right. 11,
and most of
11,
the
and then
amps go up to 10.
Exactly.
Does that mean it's louder? Is it any louder?
Well, it's one louder, isn't it? It's not 10. You see, most blokes are going to be playing at 10. You're on 10 here, all the way up, all the way up, all the way up. You're on 10 on your guitar. Where can you go from there? Where?
I don't know.
Nowhere, exactly. What we do is if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly. One louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
These go to 11.
Welcome to Conversation Radio's Lean, Mean, and Green Show right here on the Horn. It's Foxed Up with John Fox, where we turn the conversation to conservation. Foxed Up is brought to you by B1 Louder Productions in Sydney, Australia, and CityNet, citynet.net. B1 Louder by ringing 877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 877-443-2366. Or use your free minutes by dialing direct 304-658-5453. Yeah. And now, your host, the ranting, head-banging hippie, John Fox.
All right, folks, welcome aboard Foxed Up here on the Head On Radio Network. And I think you're going to enjoy what we're going to start the show with today. And we're going to have a little conversation with our good friend David after we do that about a really, really cool film. But first, I want to just go straight into the tracks of the day, and it's multiple. We have two today. I mentioned a couple weeks ago that I made some new friends, which is kind of rare these days. But I've met a couple of really, really interesting Australian musicians, and they work together, and one also does solo material, and I think you're really going to dig what you're about to hear. Now, there's links to their websites on today's show post, and for those of you that were around in the old Fourth Estate radio days, you'll remember that both Bruce and I are huge fans of an unfortunately deceased gentleman by the name of Michael Hedges, who was probably, in my mind, one of the most unbelievable, unique guitar players that's ever walked this planet. And he played... he played also an instrument called the harp guitar, which is an amazing instrument. I've always wanted to handle one, at least for a moment. And that instrument is actually like a 6 or a 12 string guitar with a 6 or 8 string bass harp attached to it. And the thing that made Michael Hedges so amazing was many of his albums were all, you know, one guy, one guitar, one stereo track, no overdubs, no mixing, no editing, with a mix of technique that encompassed classical finger style, rock picking, and, you know, Eddie Van Halen style hammer-on technique and use of harmonics that was just really unique. And I reckon this guy, Rodney Alexander, and you can check him out at his MySpace page. It's myspace.com/Rodney Alexander, just as it sounds. And he is a harp guitarist. And the track I'm going to play actually isn't on harp guitar. It's just six-string guitar. And you'll have to just keep in mind, this is one guy, one track, one take, okay? And he is also the kind of accompaniment to our second artist, which we'll get to in a minute. But Gail and I met these folks on the train as they came back from busking. And all last week they were up at the Tamworth Country Music Festival, and I'm waiting to hear how they went. I hope that they had a productive run, because I do believe that these two folks really, really deserve some attention. Both albums are amazing, they were nice enough to give me a copy of each. And Rodney's album is called Broken Lines, and I've picked a track called Slapstick because I think that this really encompasses kind of the whole feel of what Rodney's about. And I hear obvious influences of Mr. Michael Hedges. I also hear John Martin in there a bit, and there's a number of others. I mean, he's a classical guitarist by trade and by training, from what I understand. And this is fantastic stuff. So I think without further ado, Bob, please roll Slapstick, Mr. Rodney Alexander.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Rodney Alexander, and I mean, ELO reckons that there's some Lindsey Buckingham in there, and I'll agree with that a bit. Just a really, really phenomenal player, really, really nice guy. And that brings us on to the second track. Now, the second track is by a young lady by the name of Heidi Limebeer, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. And half of the tracks on the album were recorded and produced at Sydney's 301 Studios, where a couple of the Silverchair albums and many, many In Excess records and other things were recorded. However, the track I'm going to play here is actually produced and engineered by Rodney. And Rodney plays guitar for her. There's string arrangements and things on a lot of the tracks. But if you like Enya, if you like Tori Amos, if you like anything kind of ethereal, I think you're going to love this. I reckon this is some of the most beautiful kind of female vocal stuff I've heard in a long time, and the entire album is absolutely incredible. And again, this is all done on their own dollar and their own blood, sweat, and tears. And these two go down into Sydney and busk, which is some of the hardest work you can ever do. And they do this stuff out on the street. And, you know, they do gigs here and there. And I really, really think they need more attention. And another note, there is absolutely no pitch correction on this track. Not a bit. This is how she sings. And so from her album, and you can find her at myspace.com/ Heidi Limebeer, HIEDILIMEBEER. And there's tracks for you to listen to there. And I'm going to see if I can get a couple of CDs, maybe possibly to get for the horn, maybe as donation bait, to put it rudely. But because I really think that there's something here. These two people are fantastic, and they do some beautiful stuff together. So her album is called Tears in the Rain. And you can hear a live version of this track, actually, at the MySpace page. But I've picked this track called Immortal Beloved. And the lyrics are beautiful, the melody is beautiful, and the performance is just outstanding. So, Bob, please roll Immortal Beloved.
Go out to you, my immortal beloved. My angel, my whole, my very self. Much as you loved me, I love you more. My immortal
That's just absolutely gorgeous. Check out the post from today. There's links to both their sites, and you can listen to a few tracks of each. And I believe that there is information there on how you can actually buy the CDs. And please don't hesitate. I think you'll be duly impressed. I've been listening to both of these fairly consistently over the last few days, and I'm just really impressed with the organic nature, and there's obviously kind of no preconceived notion of what would be a hit. I think that this is all about creating music that moves them, and I think that that's when the best music happens, is when the musician tries to do the best that they can and create something that pleases them, and it's up to the audience to listen, and usually when it's kind of done in such a fashion, the audience catches on. But anyway, please visit. If you have a MySpace page, leave a comment. Tell them where you heard about it, and maybe we'll get them over here one day to have a bit of a chat. And because I want to know more about how they've done all this, I think it's just fantastic. Anyway, I think we need to go to the phones. If David's still there, David, you're still on the line, mate.
Yes, I am, John.
How are you, buddy?
I'm all right, and I just wanted to say I got to see Michael Hedges before he died.
I saw him once too. Amazing.
With the Flecktones, he opened up.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he opened up with Madonna's "Lucky Star."
He did some great rework.
I mentioned it before, but it was amazing. Another guitarist that I wanted to mention before I get into that. The main thing that I was talking about was, John, you gotta hear Keziah Jones, man.
Oh, I've heard the name.
The guy's insane. I sent you all his albums.
Right. I think I have them downloaded, and it's like in that list of stuff that I just haven't had time to get to yet. Okay, making a note.
Yeah. Also, I think I sent you a YouTube link of him doing All Along the Watchtower to give you just like a sampling of it. But the guy's insane. He mixes Afrobeat and Curtis Mayfield and Prince and Jimi Hendrix all together. He's from Nigeria, and he's currently a citizen of Paris, and just kind of travels all over Europe. All of his records are sold gold, so he's kind of like a semi-star. And he's amazing. His new album comes out in February, and it's engineered by the same guy who did D'Angelo's second album.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so that should be coming.
I will check that out. But you and I had this conversation arranged originally for Friday before I had to postpone the show.
That's
and
true.
You sent me this amazing documentary on Kurt Cobain, and it's based on a book of interviews. Did I catch that right?
It's now see, the amazing thing about the way that you know what it reminded me of? It reminded me of it was done differently though. It reminded me of how the Tupac documentary was done, where they would take one interview together and they would have Tupac tell his story. But what makes it what makes this documentary interesting is because they do something so brilliantly obvious that so many people miss the mark on when you tell a documentary. You don't have to make it about the person. You can make it about the people and the influences of where they're of where they came from, the heritage of it.
Yeah, and this is and what I also found really striking was the fact that virtually through the entire film, you never actually see Kurt. And as you start to get towards the end of the film, there are some live shots of the band, but his face is always obscured. And but you have these the audio track is just these taped telephone and in-person interviews with this one interviewer, where he tells the story of himself as a kid growing up and how there wasn't anything special about his situation, how his family had divorced and the breakdown and the influences that that had on his life and how that was what was happening to his entire generation.
You might have to get the director for an interview sometime, if that's at all possible.
I think you're right. I think you're right. And actually, I had intended to grab a couple of audio grabs for us to do this, but as Lennon said, that whole thing about making great plans. But the thing that I found really interesting that I found so fascinating was, there was so much made about his addictions, right?
Right.
And his explanation for what drove the heroin addiction. And this was something that I never knew, that he lived with chronic intestinal and stomach pain for most of his adult life. And it wasn't wanting to get high that drove him into heroin. It was the fact that it killed the pain, and it actually allowed him to function without pain. And I'm not using this as a way to say, hey, if you're hurting, go out and do smack. That's not the point. The point is, and if you read about people who fall into that, it's physical and mental pain that normally puts them there. And he puts a very, very human face by telling his own broken story on why he fell into it.
Well, one of the things I think that's interesting about the film is the fact that they show so many faces of different generation from different generation to generation, not just from grunge kids. They show the faces of just basically Washington, Seattle, Aberdeen, and Olympus. And I think what's important was when they explained his background, like when they started talking about what his father did, and they showed you shots of him working at a timber company, and maybe what his dad's office was like, and just basically not brushing that aside, showing what really made Kurt Cobain Kurt Cobain, but what really makes people there today. And I think one of the most interesting things was when Cobain said how everyone was disconnected in the 80s and you just had to use mixtapes and they were so cut off from the world. And see, what's interesting about that interview was that was before the internet. So you got a real kind of take of what was coming down the line, where that town would just be no longer isolated like that.
Yeah, and I think you combine the weather and the isolation. I think that was what drove a lot of the music that came out of the Northwest at the time. And I tell you, I can't thank you enough for pointing me out to this film, because I always had this impression, there are people in this world who are put here that are given an ability that is not their own to control, in which they connect with a mass of people, and they might not necessarily have the faculties to deal with what's going to come back at them. And some of that was actually dispelled by the film. He was a lot more together than I had originally thought. Even dealing when he talked about his addictions, his relationship with Courtney Love, I thought the way he described his love for her was rather astounding, because she was so kind of in your face that I got the impression that it took some of the spotlight from him, but then it ends up turning into this horrible thing where the media is all obsessed about him, her, their addictions, and the effect it's going to have on their child. And when you hear him talk about his baby, he was so protective. He hated what the media was portraying. Whether it was true or not, it was none of their goddamn business.
Yeah.
And I get the impression, I don't know if you got this impression, do you, you know, because it doesn't give you any new insight onto why he took himself out, but in the film, he mentions blowing his head off a number of times. And the question that I have to ask you, do you think it was a situation where the media was so focused on him and the excesses that by getting out of the picture, his family would get more peace?
I think it was a combination of things. I also think that because it's a known fact that his wife was trying to get her career started, and there were talks that he just didn't want to be around her because it was just this, he was just that kind of destructive nature. Now, whether Courtney convinced Kurt to stay, that's a whole different debate. But I do think that it's important to realize that that if Kurt had left, I'm looking at it the way where because Kurt committed suicide while he was still with Courtney, she was able still to launch off and people would pay more attention to her. Whereas if she left 2 months ago before he committed suicide, people wouldn't care about her that much. They would say former fiance of Kurt Cobain or whatever. I mean, I just think it was really a convenient move for her. And there's also, you know, there's also interviews of journalists talking to Courtney, and they're talking about Kurt, and she doesn't even have any emotion toward it. She just wants to talk about her record. Like, they ask her what they want to do with the funeral arrangements and stuff like this, and she's really upbeat, and she's talking about how she wants to promote a record. And I think that's, you know, the kind of person that she was. She really wanted to be a star, even if it cost Cobain his life. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where we're never going to know. But
yeah.
I was really amazed with just kind of the heartfelt kind of love that I heard, that at least this is what I picked up,
yeah,
that he had for her. And you know, I know that she was really labeled, you know, a bitch, and you know, and I mean, she's not the easiest person in the world to work with. I have friends who have had to deal with her.
Oh,
but
yeah,
she was always driven for her career.
Yeah.
I think that would have been a fact whether Kurt was there or not. And don't you think that whether Kurt lived, had never committed suicide, the media still would have wanted to make the connection between the two? And for her, just like anyone who is in a famous relationship, you want to be judged on your own merits.
Mm.
and not whether or not, you know, were you influenced by your husband? Well, no shit, yeah. Sherlock. You live together. You're going to be influenced.
Yeah.
It's kind of like it's a no-brainer. You come in contact with anyone, you are influenced by them.
I think around that time, when she started putting together her record and working with different producers and different musicians, I think that there's the element of she burned so many bridges that it's hard to say. I mean, they were both toxic for each other in a lot of different ways. But then they did have a baby together, so. I don't know, but, you know, one of the most interesting things to me about the film, on a different subject, was the overhead aerial shot. I liked. Could see that guy was a serious cameraman. He must have done a lot of aerial work too.
Oh yeah, the cinematography and the editing in it is brilliant, and I think and I really think that it is a testament to the director for the way he used the audio as a soundtrack for the pictures, but the pictures were not a literal representation of what was happening in the audio. It was a figurative thing. You know, when they talk about things like he mentioned about, you know, during his parents' divorce and whatnot, and they'd say, but, you know, I was not unique in this. This is what was happening to everybody. And
right.
They'd show just pictures of kids from the area that would have been of a similar age, and just their faces and the places, and that this was the reality of living in America at the time. I think that is one of the best things about the film, is that it tells a very, very accurate kind of story of the American family at that time. Because, I mean, my family was the same vibe, you know, the split up, the whole thing, the divorce, the remarriages, the fights between the sides, the whole thing.
Right.
And I think it put a very human, normal face on someone that had been made to be so much larger than life that he was actually just a normal, average guy who had talent. I mean, he was also a pretty damn good artist.
Yeah. I think that's what drives the soundtrack to Our Life in particular, which is a lot of dysfunction. I think people, in a weird double-edged sword, it's really made music probably one of the most powerful forces on the planet because of dysfunction. Now, what that says about our attraction for wanting that is something different entirely. But, you know, when I was watching that movie in particular, if I could, I would just talk about one scene in particular that made me wonder if it was set up or directed. I don't know if you thought the same thing, but remember the scene where they had the people, they were where the band and the kids were playing in Olympus?
Mm-hmm.
They were playing music in Olympus?
Yeah.
And they had one scene where they were playing in the alley, and then they had a guy, like, in the background come walking, and he looked like something out of a Fellini movie. It was like...
Yeah, that's right!
And, yeah. And I started to think, is that the movie, or is that just... Was that the point? You see, that's the beauty of a film like that. You can't tell if that's the movie or that's reality right in front of you.
Well, I think so much of that footage was captured reality. I would think, you know what I mean? I think that, you know, that little, you know, showing that impromptu concert kind of thing in the middle of the alleyway was probably something that still goes on.
I would imagine so. I've never been to Olympus, so I can't say. But it did seem kind of interesting how Kurt kind of even rejected that. It was like he rejected everything he became close to, except his family. Like he, when he was talking about how he really didn't like any of the musicians there. And
and they were going in. Yeah, and you know how many times he had quit Nirvana during their heyday.
Yeah, that too.
And you know that you know he could give all of it up because it had suddenly become unreal, as opposed to something that was, you know, driven by the desire to create and becoming part of the machine, which kind of thankfully, because it was still towards the end of when we still had record labels that worked with talent as opposed to manufacturing it, they were able to maintain some level of control. But I also didn't realize that he and the bass player really didn't care for each other much. But it was because they created something special amongst the three of them that they didn't push each other's buttons, which I think is a great testament to someone's character on both parts.
I tell you what bugged me out. When he was talking about how he would have dinners with the A&R people, and he was talking about... And one of these A&R people told him, so this song, Polly, did you rape the bitch? I was like, holy cow. I was not even expecting that.
And you wonder, and anyone wonders why, you know, musicians and other folks end up absolutely despising that side of the media, you know, when you know you work hard to create something, and they want to ask you stupid things like that, and you know, and it's just trying to dig for some sort of shock value, as though the music itself, with its, you know, mix of pop hookiness and punk, wasn't enough of a shock to the senses, you know, that you need to have the, you know, you need to try and say, you know, did you rape her? You know, it's just like, give me a break. And I got a new understanding for someone that and opened up a whole bunch more questions, but it gave me a new understanding about what the guy was like, because these interviews are that are in the audio track are very, very relaxed.
Very,
you know, that they're really, really open, free flowing. He's just kind of telling the story. The interviewer actually drives very little. He only gets in there to kind of, you know, move it along a little bit or move it to a direction, and then he just allows Kurt to tell his story. And you know, and Kurt goes off about journalists at one point, and he ends up saying, but you're actually different, because and thanks him at the end of the final interview, because in a rare instance he was talked to as a human being with a story, as opposed to some sort of, you know, freak that is there to be put up and kind of pointed at and ridiculed, but yet, you know, we love his music.
Yeah, and one of the things that I noticed that was an interesting metaphor was when he was talking about his paintings, and he said, I like to see people, it's like a Psych 101 moment, I like to see people from the inside. And all of his drawings, he had people from the inside.
Yeah. Go ahead.
You know, when you're watching a film like that, and you look at what someone's totality of their life in a space of 2 hours, I think one of the most amazing things is that you got a journalist to talk somebody like that, and they snip together, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 interviews, and it really did sound like one conversation, which makes you think, was this conversation meant to be? the narrative of this film, I mean, to me, that's one of the most amazing parts about it.
Yeah, and, you know, and you can hear, you know, you can hear where, you know, the audio quality changes, where, you know, it's obviously over a telephone, and then there's other stuff where it was obviously kind of face-to-face with probably a tape recorder and a microphone. And it's very cleverly edited, because I reckon that the interviews themselves didn't have the continuity that you have in the film, but it's very, very, very cleverly spliced together, not spliced to change the meaning of any of it, but to put continuity to the story as they kind of develop, you know, from his early years as a kid all the way up until, you know, the present moment of those interviews taking place. And it's just, you know, it's a purely amazing film. And I don't think I've quite ever seen anything quite like it. It's rather amazing.
I think one of the things it does also is it opens the door for the future of documentaries in music in particular, where maybe but some directors seeing this, they realize you don't have to make it about the band so much. You don't have to take shots of the band necessarily. You can do anything you want with a documentary if it tells the story.
Absolutely. No doubt about it, man. No doubt about it, man. I tell you what, I've got about 15 minutes or so to go. And the one thing that I actually didn't catch, what is the actual name of the film?
About a Son.
About a Son. Folks, seriously, even if you weren't into Nirvana, as far as a film goes and telling a fairly interesting life story, go check this film out, because I got a couple things I want to get to before I get done here, David. But I really appreciate that film. It was as a piece of just as just the piece of film, you know, the movie itself as a piece of work, it's outstanding.
I just want to say it's a really atmospheric, really visually stimulating film, and I think people should check it out. If you can't check it out in theaters, you know, just check it out on DVD when it comes your way, and just watch it for the story of basically Washington itself in the 80s and 90s, and telling the story of the X generation, the older generation, the generation that went to war, the generation afterwards, just basically people in general who lived in Washington.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's actually less about Kurt, in a way.
Yeah.
As it is about an entire area of the country and a bit of a time capsule of the American family in many ways.
Oh, without a doubt. And I think I was just wanted to say that the next thing that I have for you to watch, you're going to really want to do a segment on it. I think it's going to make you scream too. I played it on the radio for someone. They played the whole segment, and it's amazing footage. I'm just going to leave it at that, and it's going to wake a lot of people up. And I don't think a lot of people have heard about it either. That's a damn shame thing about it, but you know, just keep that in people's minds for next time, I guess.
All right, mate. Well, always a pleasure, and thank you so much for all the kind of stuff that you send to me, because, you know, I try to keep up, but no one can keep up on everything, and I have to say, you've never sent me something that didn't at least intrigue me.
No problem, John. You take it easy, and you knock out the rest of the hour now.
All right, mate. Take care of yourself. And that was our good mate, David from Maine. And seriously, About a Son, check it out. It really is that good. A fantastic film. And boy, we're pulling a filibobster here. No breaks. I guess a lot of the content that I had for today will end up being pushed off till tomorrow, because this Bob sent me two pieces, and they're both from the New York Times. One we talked about during the horn section, which is Good Jobs Are Where the Money Is, which I think is a fascinating piece. But the parents or the piece that went with it that he sent me about our new global oil quandary and how our calories of food are becoming painfully expensive, and it's going to get worse. And we really, really, really need to find, not find, start using the options that are available to us, because we're headed for some serious trouble, and it's only now going to be worse. Bob pops into the chat and says to me how India's trading index took a 15.5% dive in Tuesday trading. Trade was halted just minutes after morning trading opened. Okay? So we have Australia wiping off a huge amount over the last few days. The United States has not been doing very well, and you've all had a holiday. Tomorrow is going to be a bad, bloody day. And I do not wish this on anyone, but I see traders jumping. And it's happened before, because they're going to lose their shirts. Also, Bob's telling me trading was stopped Tuesday in South Korea as well. And, you know, this is all not good. And I hate to be really heavy and down and ugly and about it, but seriously, we got to wake up. I mean, a lot of you know this, but the people who make these decisions need, have to, must be forced to stop looking out for their short-term interests and their own profits and start thinking about the larger picture, because you can only have a small, minuscule part of the population feeding off the masses for so long. At some point, there's going to be nothing left to feed on. And I mean, maybe the big crash is what this bloody planet needs. We're overpopulated, so a famine will clear out some of the population. We're using way too many resources. Food is going to become so bloody expensive that none of us are going to be able to afford to eat fresh food. Start planting your victory gardens now. You know, like Nanette, you know, she's a canning monster. I think she's got it. I think she's got the right idea. Yeah, Bob just brings up Soylent Green. This is, you know, I mean, this is, I've been screaming about this on and off for the past year. And the central bank, or banks in many nations, are not driving the right policy. It's horrible. Their policy drives their profits, as opposed to the long-term stability of our economies. And I'd much rather live in a society than survive in an economy. But we've got these systems in place now where it's going to be all of us little guys that are going to get hammered. And I'm so glad that I have my life down to where I'm not living on credit. If I don't have the cash, I don't do it. Yeah. Miss November in the chat room, quoting Kissinger, you control the food, you control the population. And we got that's a many faceted kind of situation there between GM crops being owned by patent by outfits like Monsanto, and mainly Monsanto. The fact that our mechanized farming systems are not sustainable. We have to start, you know, producing more locally. You know, the idea that, you know, you'll go and buy grain from Australia, ship it to, say, China to be processed, and the processed stuff ends up being then shipped to the United States, maybe to be made into candy bars or some other thing, and then gets shipped back here to Australia for me to buy? How is this efficient? How is it efficient when it's been decided and we have this logic that it is cheaper to pull oil out of the ground, manufacture it into plastics to create plastic utensils, and that is cheaper than actually using a normal bloody spoon, fork, and knife and washing it in your house. And Bob's got another great point. You know, you got to think about all the amount of really good farmland in the United States that's been turned into McMansion developments. What are we doing with our land? What are we doing with our world? We have set up a system where profit drives everything, and the good of the people and the feeding of the people is not even a consideration. It's the profit first. And because of the way that we have this situation, and the fact that oil prices and the fight for biofuels is going to drive the cost of fresh food up, processed food doesn't get the hits as fast because, well, it's further on down the line. It takes a lot longer for the bloody candy bar to see the price hike than it is for the zucchini at the market. Just as one of those examples, and I know I've said this before, I still can't figure out why here in Australia, you know, there are a few things in life that I'm really, really picky about when it comes to food. And one of them is whole egg mayonnaise. It's not hard. Australians got convinced that this garbage that we call Miracle Whip in the United States is mayonnaise. But the only two whole egg mayonnaises I can find in Australia, one comes from San Francisco, and the other one, I believe, comes from Belgium. And you're telling me that it's more efficient to make it over there, put it on a boat, something that is made with eggs, olive oil, and mustard powder. Yeah. Gail and I have made our mayo, or Gail has, and it's genius. But this is the point. It's exactly the point. Why? You cannot tell me that you cannot pay an Australian to make it for Australian shelves. That's the point I'm trying to make. But because they're able to make more profit at the end, you can't even get it here. No one's making it here. There were neighbors of ours that, unfortunately, we met them just as they were moving, and the bloke was Canadian, and they just recently moved up to Queensland, and I hope they're doing all right, because Queensland's been getting their ass flooded out like you wouldn't believe at the moment. They want to actually start making real maple syrup in Australia because it's all imported. And they reckon it would be a whole lot more environmentally friendly to find a way to actually grow and make it here than to have to ship it all from Canada. But see, it's this holy profit motive that drives it, as opposed to actually making the system work. And this cannot continue. It cannot, it will not work. It's not working now. It's a system that is just absolutely running out of the fuel that's been driving it, which is cheap labor. Unbelievable. So, but we'll do this whole oil and fuel thing tomorrow because I didn't want to kind of rush through it in 15 minutes. And David, I originally had scheduled for last Thursday, and I had to put him off because of me not doing a show. So I appreciate that. I appreciate David ringing in because it really is an interesting film. That it really, really is. So we'll pick up where we left off tomorrow, folks. And please check out Heidi Limebeer and check out Rodney Alexander. The links are at the Foxed Up blog on the HeadOnRadioNetwork.com site. And thanks to Bob for producing. Thanks to Scott Berry, Heidi, and Rod for the music today. Thanks to Coal River Mountain Watch for everything they do. I can't wait to see the film. And thanks to you guys for spending your time with me. Thanks to David. And as we say here on Foxed Up, be good, be green. We'll see you tomorrow.
If ever I would stop thinking about music and politics, I would tell you that sometimes it's easier to desire and pursue the attention and admiration of 100 strangers than it is to accept the love and loyalty of those closest to me. And I would tell you that sometimes I prefer to look at myself through someone else's eyes, eyes that aren't clouded with the tears of knowing what an asshole I can be, as yours are. If ever I would stop thinking about music and politics, I might be able to listen in silence to your concerns, rather than hearing everything as an accusation or an indictment against me. I would tell you that sometimes I use sex to avoid communication. It's the best escape when we're down on our luck. But I can express more emotions than laughter, anger, and let's f***. If ever I would stop thinking about music and politics. If ever I would stop thinking about music and politics.